Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a couple of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and speak with the former head of the Peace Corps under President Clinton. Mark Schneider was the director of the Peace Corps, and we'll be talking to him about the situation in Darfur and the humanitarian disaster in the Sudan. And he also, when he was at the Peace Corps, he launched a major effort in Africa to do AIDS, HIV education. So I'll be looking into what happened at the conference in Thailand that just ended a couple of days ago and what has been happening since he was the director of the Peace Corps in terms of a lack of funding for HIV education because of pressure from conservative Christians who believe abstinence is the cure for AIDS. We'll also speak with investigative reporter Max Blumenthal, who writes for Salon and American Prospect. He's just done an investigative piece on the genesis of the recent coup in Haiti and the role of the International Republican Institute, a little-known group in that coup. We'll be looking into that. Plus, he's also done an investigative piece on Republicans for Nader, the extent to which Ralph Nader's presidential campaign is being funded by Republicans, where an organization, Citizens for a Sound Economy, led by former House Majority Leader Dick Armey, is helping both in efforts for Ralph Nader to get on ballots, gathering signatures for him to get on ballots in pivotal states, and also direct funding from some very, very wealthy but extremely conservative people like the Koch family who have been putting money into Nader's campaign. And we'll also we'll go to Israel and talk with David Newman, who's a professor of political science at Ben Gurion University in Israel. And we'll be talking to him about the crisis within the Palestinian Authority, where Yasser Arafat tried to put his nephew in charge of the security apparatus, and that sort of flagrant cronyism erupted. The reaction to it was involved kidnappings and beatings, and the general impression is that the Palestinian Authority is losing its grasp, and we'll look into that, given that David Newman is a part of the Track 2 group, who are a group of Israelis and Palestinians, academics, professionals, businessmen, etc., who have been keeping the avenues open in spite of the bleak prospects at the political level between Sharon and Arafat. But the fear has always been that there will be nobody left on the Palestinian side to negotiate with. And, of course, that plays into the hands of the Israeli right, who basically say, we told you so, and Arabs are incapable of governing themselves. So because this happens in the context of a meeting that's taking place, as we speak now, in Jerusalem between Sharon and the former Labour leader, Shimon Peres, negotiating a coalition government to bring the Labour back into the fold and to revive the peace talks and the Gaza withdrawal. So there'll be quite a bit to talk about. I'm now speaking with Mark Schneider, who was the director of the Peace Corps under President Bill Clinton, and he's currently the senior vice president of the International Crisis Group. And Mark Schneider, this is not the first time we've had a crisis in the Sudan, and certainly in the neighborhood there, Ethiopia and Somalia. There seems to be perennial humanitarian disasters, usually involving starvation. The word genocide is being raised, and it is extremely loaded term, genocide, and it would seem that it's a term that one shouldn't use loosely because you don't want to devalue it. At the same time, I believe because there's been a genocide convention at the United Nations, there has to be a standard. So just let's clarify that. Where do we stand in terms of genocide?
Unfortunately, we're, depending on your perspective, clearly the atrocities and ethnic cleansing that's taken place in Darfur, that is in the western part of Sudan, would constitute at least the grounds for genocide. Most people in the Senate and House legislation declared it to be genocide this week in measures that were introduced. The conditions are the following. You had the government of Sudan supporting a Arab militia who burned and pillaged the villages of essentially African Muslims over the course of the past 8 months, producing some 1.2 million people who were forced to flee their villages into the wilderness. Now, many of them are in camps, but those camps are essentially controlled by the same militias that forced them out of their homes. Another 200,000 have fled across the border to Chad. And those individuals are still being prevented by the government of Sudan of receiving the kind of humanitarian relief that's essential for them to survive. So under those conditions, one would have to say that the government of Sudan and the militia have engaged in ethnic cleansing, and those actions clearly constitute the grounds for genocide.
Now, what can one discern is the motive for the Janjaweed militia to conduct this Muslim-on-Muslim, African-upon-African violence?
What happened was that early last year, the rebel groups in Darfur essentially attempted to attack government police and other forces in an effort to reverse decades-long discrimination against these African farming communities. And when the government's response was totally out of proportion and in terms of unleashing this Janjaweed militia, bombing villages with the government armed forces planes, and destroying the villages, throwing bodies down wells, burning their livestock and their fields, and essentially creating conditions under which they inevitably would die unless there is humanitarian relief provided. And then the government denied humanitarian access to those camps. And that's the situation until very recently when, as you know, Secretary General Kofi Annan and Secretary of State Colin Powell went to Darfur and attempted to get agreement for the government to abide by a ceasefire that it had agreed to under the auspices of the African Union in April. Unfortunately, it violated that ceasefire virtually from the time it was penned. And even in the last several days, the United Nations humanitarian coordinator, Jan Egelin, has spoken about UN convoys being attacked by the Janjaweed. There's a story today of a school that the Janjaweed militia, girls' school, burned and killed young girls. We had stories during the last week of the Janjaweed. Essentially, they control the surroundings of all of these camps where the internally displaced are located. And as young women go out to gather firewood, they attack, rape them, and in some instances kill them. So the situation is really horrible. And it will get worse. This is the rainy season. And so in that part of the world, when the rainy season comes, as it ends, you usually have an outbreak of cholera and malaria. When you have these kinds of camps with very little in the way of clean water and virtually nothing in the way, I think it's 20% to 30% of any kind of sanitation, you have the conditions that will undoubtedly unleash an epidemic that the head of AID has indicated is likely even now, even if you were to get full access, to result in more than 100,000 dead.
But, Mark Schneider, again, it's very difficult to get a handle on the motives of the Janjaweed and, by extension, the government that is turning a blind eye and obviously colluding with them while denying the collusion. we understood, for example, in what the motives of the Serbs and Milosevic were, basically criminal, but based upon this sort of sense of grievance that the Serbs, historical grievance, mm-hmm, and it was mm-hmm. like reminiscent of the Nazis' Lebensraum, you know, we need more living room. So you can't accept their rationale, but at least you can understand it.
In this case, it's really the Arab Muslims that are, in a sense, that also live in Darfur, who make up the Janjaweed. They have historically been nomadic. On the other hand, the African Muslims in Darfur have historically been sedentary farming communities. And what's been, and they at the same time have generally been discriminated against by the Arabs who control the country as a whole. And what has occurred is when they tried to get greater autonomy through these rebel actions a year ago, the government decided not only not to permit this kind of, in a sense, rebellion, but to destroy it and to take the land and to essentially attempt to force them out in order to permit the Arab Janjaweed and their colleagues to essentially take over that territory.
So it's not religious, it's racial.
It's racial rather than religious, that's correct. Mm-hmm.
And in terms of the humanitarian disaster, I mean, if the government is either encouraging this ethnic cleansing, they're clearly making it difficult for the aid to get through, and the only other way would be through Chad, which is landlocked and a desperately poor country to begin with. So what's the status on what's in the pipeline and when it's going to get there?
Well, right now the estimate is that some 30 to 40% of the internally displaced have been reached with some kind of humanitarian assistance. 60 to 70% have not. There are essentially three ways. One is from getting food and other materials into the port in Sudan and then getting it transported to Darfur. The other is to go overland from Libya. Libya has just agreed to permit this. Government of Sudan has not yet accepted that, to go across the border on land. Similarly, from Chad, it has blocked and made it difficult for transportation, and the rains will make it very difficult. This is going to be a monumental task, even if it is in a permissive environment. That is, even if the government of Sudan were to lift entirely all restrictions, all constraints, all visa, registration, travel, et cetera, obstacles, it would still be a monumental task. At this point, the UN has stated that it's received, in terms of pledges, some 40% of what it needs. The U.S. is in the lead, but even the U.S. has not, at this point, not fully positioned all of the materials that would be desirable. There's probably additional amounts that need to be provided, and hopefully that will be done. But mainly, I would say at this point, the Europeans and others need to step up to the plate with respect to their contributions on the humanitarian side. By the way, the UN is considering a draft resolution which would say, or which we think it should say, if you don't comply with all of these requirements, i.e. disarm the Janjaweed, end all restrictions, permit total free access by humanitarian agencies, permit international monitoring fully, not only of the humanitarian situation, but of the human rights situation in Darfur, then the United Nations, under Chapter 7, will do it by force. And the United States has introduced a resolution which is slightly weaker than that. The International Crisis Group has suggested amendments, and some other countries have indicated that they will offer those to the U.S. resolution, and hopefully the U.S. will accept them. I think it's likely that they will. But that resolution needs to move forward.
Now, but is that a realistic threat that military force would be employed?
I mean, well,
we're given the resources are overstretched. We've got mm-hmm, Afghanistan, mm-hmm. We've got Iraq.
It doesn't really have to be the United States, in a sense, sending its troops. The United States and Europe, what they need to do at this point is to provide logistics for an expanded African Union force a peacekeeping kind of force that some of the African countries have offered in other instances. That needs to be put together. There also is the possibility, we believe, of bringing together the UN has a particular, what they call the Sherbrig Brigade. It's a standby high readiness brigade. It's made up largely of European nations, and it needs to be called into being, if you will. It's like a reserve, mm-hmm. and it needs to be called into, or at least authorized to be brought to bear if, as they say, the situation doesn't change immediately. And that could be done. And it's generally the view that that it would be possible. There may be sort of interim steps. If the government of Sudan does not halt the resupply of the Janjaweed by air, the UN could declare a no-fly zone in the humanitarian corridors to permit the humanitarian organizations to supply the internally displaced in those camps without fear. This African Union force would essentially provide protection to the civilians mm-hmm. in those camps, and the logistic support for that would come from the U.S. and the EU, probably through funding a contracting for others to actually provide the equipment.
Let me again remind the audience, if I may, I'm speaking with Mark Schneider, who was the director of the Peace Corps under President Bill Clinton and is now a senior vice president of the International Crisis Group. And we're talking about the humanitarian disaster in the Sudan and what could be done, not necessarily what will be done, but what could be done to avert what some people are describing as genocide. And just in closing, just to somewhat change the subject, when you in the Peace Corps, at the head of the Peace Corps, Mark Schneider, you established a new initiative in expanding HIV/AIDS prevention education in Africa. And, of mm-hmm. course, the conference in Bangkok just ended, there's a lot of the United States was singled out as by most of the world as being out of step in terms of its restrictions on condoms because of pressure from the Christian right in this country, who believe that abstinence is the cure rather than, and that condoms, in fact, encourage promiscuity rather than, and I mean, it's pretty clear, medically speaking, that it's about the only thing we have, isn't it?
Not the only thing, but it clearly is one of the crucial elements in an overall strategy of prevention that not only provides education, but also condoms and encouragement for people to avoid promiscuous sexual behavior.
Right. So the ABC...
ABC, yes. In the other words, if you don't do ABC, then you get D, which is death.
Right.
And there needs to be a clear expansion and assistance through not just prevention, but also in counseling, care for the orphans, and treatment. And that needs to be done on an expanded basis throughout not only sub-Saharan Africa, but in many of the, increasingly in the countries outside of Africa that are also showing very high rates of increase in HIV prevalence. And that includes India, China, and Russia.
But in terms of the ABC, there's no prioritizing A, abstinence. It's just because it's the first letter in the alphabet, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right.
But what's happened to what you did when under President Clinton as the head of the Peace Corps?
No, that continues. I mean, what we did was we essentially said that every volunteer working in Africa, whether they're in education or in agriculture or small business, that they will also be trained on HIV/AIDS prevention and how you communicate that in the community.
Why was the rest of the world angry at the United States?
Well, in this particular instance, it was, as you say, because of the view that the U.S. has restricted some of its funding to organizations like UNFPA and others with respect to population, and because of the prominence given to abstinence. One would hope that the new funding that the U.S. is providing through this new fund, the additional funds that the U.S. is providing through this PEPFAR fund, The rest of the world believes in it more than the U.S. wants should go through the Global Fund. The U.S. plans of about $2 billion this year that the U.S. will be spending on international AIDS. The U.S. is proposing, I believe, to transfer only $200 million to the Global Fund. Most of the people at that conference felt there should be a larger contribution.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Mark Schneider.
Not at all. Thank you for the opportunity.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking there with Mark Schneider, who was the director of the Peace Corps under President Bill Clinton, is now a senior vice president of the International Crisis Group, and we were talking about the humanitarian disaster in the Sudan. I'm now speaking with David Newman, who is a professor of political science at Ben-Gurion University in Israel, and you've been looking at the evening news there in Israel as we speak, David, and clearly what's happening in the West Bank and in particular in Gaza is quite disturbing. Now, does this mean, it seems to me that perhaps what's really happening there with the chaos and the fratricide, that within the Palestinian Authority, his Arafat's Al-Aqsa Brigade are actually going against his own authority. So what's happening here is this, are the Palestinians a defeated people, and this is just essentially what's going to happen now? You'll have chaos and fratricide.
I would put it the other way around. The fact that the Palestinians are becoming increasingly divided amongst themselves, first of all, obviously between Hamas and the Fatah, and now, as you can see in the last few days, just within the Fatah itself, two factions of the Fatah, with Hamas standing outside and watching, that makes it more difficult for them to put up a united front, against Israel and so on. So it's not a question of because they're defeated, therefore they become divided. It works the other way around as well.
But doesn't it, in a sense, play into the hands of the hardliners in Israel who will say, see, we told you so, these people are incapable of governing themselves?
Oh, definitely, and we've heard these sort of statements coming out throughout the weekend and especially this morning. All those, including Sharon, who says, we're unilaterally imposing the disengagement agreement on the other side. We're not negotiating because we don't have a partner. We don't have a leader who can maintain law and order amongst the Palestinian Authority. This, for him, is proof of that.
But you have a situation there where Arafat appears to be corrupt and feckless, and Barghouti, who many people thought was going to be the next leader, is the Israelis have jailed him for, I think, 20-something years. And the interim prime minister that we have now, Karai, has resigned. So who's in charge?
Well, Arafat doesn't like having people who challenge his authority, and therefore the first prime minister, of course, he appointed Abu Mazen, was a bit too independent for him, so he went very quickly. And actually, the present prime minister, Abu Ala, really hasn't managed to push anything forward in an independent manner without having Arafat's permission or authority, authorization in the first place. What you do raise is a very important question. Now, I've been watching the news through the day from the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, and you have a lot of Palestinian voices who in the past would not have been publicly critical, even if they felt so privately, would not have been publicly critical of Arafat's leadership, coming out very strongly against Arafat's appointment of his relation as the head of the security forces in the Gaza Strip. One person started shouting, why do we have to replace corruption with even greater corruption? Now, these are the sort of voices that Palestinians did not publicly air in the past, but they're obviously very frustrated with Arafat's leadership.
Well, but hasn't the sticking point always been, and the reason for Abu Mazen's resignation was that he couldn't control the security services, and I imagine that that's the reason why Abu Ala just is quitting as well. And now if Arafat is trying to put his, I think it was his nephew, wasn't it?
His nephew.
So is that what it comes down to, is who's in charge of the security forces? And it seems at this point that the security forces themselves are in disarray.
Well, I think, up until recently, particularly, I'm looking at it from the, in a sense, from the Israeli side of the fence. Mm-hmm. We've always been aware in the last few years that Arafat doesn't have total authority and that the Hamas particularly in the Gaza Strip, are gradually taking that authority away from him. And, of course, there are a lot of question marks concerning Israel's disengagement from Gaza. You know, who would fill the power vacuum in the Gaza Strip if the Israeli forces withdraw? Would it be Hamas or the Palestinian Authority? But now what we're seeing is something new. It's within the Fatah itself. There's a division as to who should be the leader, who should be the authority, and who is considered to be a corrupt leadership and who is considered to be a clean leader, if you want it that way.
But what's left there in terms? I mean, I recall we all saw it on television, the destruction of the infrastructure. The first thing that Sharon went after was the Palestinian police, the infrastructure. Remember, they blew up Arafat's plane. They blew up his headquarters on more than one occasion. So you get the impression that how can you expect people to administer law and order if the infrastructure of law and order has been destroyed?
Yeah, there's no question. I agree with you. Israel has played its part in destroying that infrastructure, both the physical infrastructure and the security infrastructure. And at one and the same time, we want and we expect and we demand Arafat to control, his own internal security and to prevent terror and so on. So that is very problematic.
And where does it stand today? Because you have this, as we speak, David Newman, Peres and Sharon are sitting down trying to broker a deal for a coalition government where Labour brings itself into the fold, and therefore you have a functioning majority, and presumably that's going to marginalise the Likud hardliners and the small religious parties.
Well, at this very moment, the first night of negotiations between the Labour and Likud party teams has just broken up. Former leader of the Labour Party, Binyamin Ben-Eliezer, or Fuad, gave an interview and said that all they had agreed on this evening was how to conduct the negotiations and what the basic principles of each party should be in a national unity government. And of course, he came out very strongly to tell the Israeli public that we haven't yet discussed who will get what portfolios in the cabinet and so on, so as not to make it look as though they just want to be there for the seat, but that there are some basic ideological principles involved. Sharon gave a speech today to a group of visiting Jewish delegation, and he stated quite simply and quite categorically to them that he wanted to broaden his government because he does not have the necessary majority in the present government to push the disengagement plan through, and therefore he has to bring in parties who will give him that majority and who will support his disengagement plan.
But Peres wants more, doesn't he? He wants a broader plan. He wants some sort of, I guess, some kind of return to some vestige of Oslo.
Yeah, well, I would assume they're going to be discussing that in the coalition discussions, and I would have thought the Labour Party would be pushing Sharon Likud to make some statements or to change their position, and I doubt very much if Sharon Likud are going to do it. But, of course, the Labour Party, who at the moment, anyway, are very weak. I mean, they only have 19 seats. They're the lowest they've ever had in the history of the state, are really sort of between the hammer and the anvil. If they stay out, then there will be many people who will accuse them of not doing their part in supporting the disengagement plan. If they go in, there will be those people who accuse them of going into a government which is only undertaking a minimalist operation, getting out of Gaza and not doing anything about the rest of the roadmap. So whichever way you look at it, they're a lose-lose situation for the Labour Party.
Well, it's interesting, Bill Clinton's memoirs have been out for now for a few weeks, and he describes his last-minute efforts to bring about an agreement, and basically the agreement was scuttled. Clinton blames it on Arafat. He says, Arafat sort of rather unctuously said to him, after he turned the deal down, you'll be a great man, and history will record you as a great man, and Clinton said, no, I'm not, I'm a failure, and I'm a failure because of you. Looking at Arafat. So what happened there? Because that seems to be the point where the whole thing went off the rails. And on the Palestinian side, people argue that the deal that he was offered was absolutely, Swiss cheese. There was no real state. But on the other hand, if you get this you get into this all or nothing situation that the Palestinian position seems to be, you end up with nothing. And of course, every day that goes by that you don't have an agreement between Israel and Palestine, the situation just gets worse. So do you have a handle on it that, you know, why?
Well, I mean, you know, there are alternative narratives as to why both the Camp David and the Taba talks failed.
Right.
The Palestinian narrative is that Barak just put it on the table and said, take it or leave it, there's no negotiation. The Israeli narrative is, look, we, you know, offered them 96% of the West Bank and they still couldn't reach an agreement. And, of course, like all of these narratives, both are partly true to a certain extent. But there can be no doubt that the Clinton proposals, which Barak, so it would appear, was prepared to back, were far-reaching. And at the very least, they could have proved the basis for a comprehensive agreement or for comprehensive discussions leading to a final agreement. And the fact that they broke up completely, you know, from offering an extensive proposal to breaking up completely and giving us back the violence that we've had in the past 3 years, I think is for many people, you know, looking back now in retrospect of 3 years, looking at the violence and the terror and the suicide bombings and the collapse of the Palestinian Authority, I think for many people on both sides, it's quite incomprehensible.
Well, Clinton also said to Arafat, apparently, at least according to Clinton's memoirs, that you turning this deal down means that from now on, Likud is going to be in power and you're going to end up with a worse situation. So, I mean, it was pretty clear that not only was Clinton hung out to dry, but Barak was as well. And the question that comes up all the time is, well, maybe Arafat turned it down because he's afraid, and I think he's indicated this. He said that he'd be assassinated. So who was Arafat afraid of, if you believe that?
Well, I think, first of all, just another comment. Let's say Barak was hung out to dry, not because of the failure of Camp David. He was hung out to dry because he failed to command the support of his own party, who turned very strongly against him. He wasn't a good sort of coalition manager of his own political party. And then, of course, there's always the argument in Israel that only the right wing can sort of push forward peace proposals, like Begin pushed forward Camp David, and Sharon is pushing forward the disengagement now, and then it's always much more difficult for the Labour Party to implement more far-reaching peace agreements. Coming back to Arafat, of course, you know, we look through history and we look at various struggles for national freedom and independence, and of course there are those leaders who are guerrilla leaders or terrorist leaders in the past who successfully managed to make the transition into sort of first prime ministers of a newly post-colonial state. There are those who have failed to do so miserably, and I think most people would agree Arafat failed to do so. He didn't grab the chances which he had, and clearly he was afraid that, you know, there were too many radicals on his side who would want to get him out of the way, who would see him as a traitor. At the time of Camp David, there was the issue that the two major regional powers, Saudi Arabia and Egypt, did not really give the public backing that maybe Arafat needed to push the agreement through. And I think it's very clear today, both from Saudi Arabia's statements in the post-9/11 era and Egyptian desire to be involved in the Gaza disengagement, that they did not take the right direction at that time. And had they given a bit more public support, maybe Arafat would have gone in a different direction.
But you're saying they're giving that now, though?
Well, I wouldn't say they're publicly giving it, but clearly Saudi Arabia has calmed down its statements on the Arab-Israel conflict. And, of course, just 2 years ago, there was the Saudi initiative.
Sure.
It may have been partly pushed by the Americans in the post-9/11 era, but nevertheless, that is very significant if you're an Arab living in the Middle East. And now there's the case of the Egyptians being prepared to be involved in the Gaza disengagement to control the security forces. The only thing is, of course, the Palestinians don't want the Egyptians. I was at a Track 2 meeting last week where one Palestinian said, what do we want to replace the Israeli occupation with? An Egyptian occupation. So that's not exactly the sort of third party that the Palestinians are looking for in the transition stage.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, David Newman. Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters, and I'm just speaking then with David Newman, who is a professor of political science at Ben Gurion University in Israel. He was giving us an update on what is happening both in terms of the negotiations going on now between Sharon and Peres to form a coalition government with the what's left of the Labour Party, plus the disintegration of central authority in the Palestinian territories, in particular Gaza. And David is a member of the Track 2 group, who are a group of Israelis and Palestinians who have been negotiating around and in spite of Arafat and Sharon. And clearly they're concerned that there's not going to be anybody left on the Palestinian side to talk to if chaos continues. I'm joined in the studio by Max Blumenthal, who's a reporter, an investigative reporter who writes for Salon.com and The American Prospect. And you've got a piece out now in Salon, Max, the other regime change. Did the Bush administration network of right-wing Republicans foment a violent coup in Haiti? So this is kind of a post-mortem, I guess, on what went down. And,
right.
And the finger you point at is at the International Republican Institute. So give us a sense of how the IRI is structured and funded. I know it's a part of which is the bureaucracy. Well, you tell me.
Well, there's a lot of fingers to point. I only have 10 on my hand. But I think one thing that needs to be focused on in this instance is the International Republican Institute. And I think it's a good time to do it a day after Haiti's 200th anniversary of freeing itself from colonialism. Essentially, the International Republican Institute, since it was created in 1983, has been an instrument of the Republican Party to impose a sort of de facto political colonialism on a lot of countries in Latin America that are, you know, that tend to be neglected by the executive branch. In the 1980s, there was a movement among a lot of foreign policy intellectuals, these kind of B-level foreign policy intellectuals, like Alan Weinstein, for example, who is now the head of Bush's head of the National Archive, to create so-called pro-democracy organizations that would promote democracy in countries that were under communist rule, or countries in Central America that were supposedly under threat of communist rule. So they created the National Endowment for Democracy, and the U.S. Agency for International Development, known as USAID, was also involved in this. And what they did, what the National Endowment for Democracy did, was they created two sort of subsidiaries that would get into these countries and work on the ground to bolster various parties. There's the National Democratic Institute, which is affiliated with the Democratic Party, and the International Republican Institute, which is affiliated with the Republican Party and is chaired by John McCain. You know, on its board are various ideologues like Gene Kirkpatrick, who's a longtime apologist for authoritarian repressive regimes in Central America. And what the International Republican Institute has traditionally done is trained and bolstered the opponents of regimes that are deemed hostile to U.S. interests, which tend to be left-wing populist regimes, in El Salvador, Daniel Ortega, and in Haiti, Jean-Bertrand Aristide.
But what happened to this idea that we have a bipartisan foreign policy? I mean, this is amazing that you would have a Democratic group and a Republican group, and obviously since the Republicans are in power, the IRI probably has a lot more money and more clout. So this is an open invitation to take off the fig leaf of bipartisanship in foreign policy.
Well, each are funded equally, but the IRI manages to probably outdo the National Democratic Institute with corporate money from groups like Exxon, and also.
So it's a 501c3, is it?
It is a 501c3. That's which means it's supposed to be nonpartisan. It's also interesting, if it's a 501c3, there's no accountability to the public, even though it's mostly taxpayer funded. And Haiti's a long-time political football in Washington. I mean, you know, there was a coup in 1990. Aristide was ousted under the first Bush administration. You know, Dick Cheney was the defense chief. So you have this nexus between the first Bush administration and the second Bush administration. Aristide was perceived as the Fidel Castro of Haiti by Jesse Helms, and these people needed a way to get into Haiti and prevent Aristide from gaining a foothold. Aristide, was swept to power by a popular democracy movement after the dictator Duvalier crumbled. And after the coup, what happened was a group called FRAP came into power, which is very similar to ARENA in El Salvador. They were essentially a military regime that used death squads to terrorize Aristide supporters. They massacred thousands of Aristide supporters, and at the same time, they were supported by the U.S. and by characters like Jesse Helms, and they were led by Raul Cedras, who is an army officer trained by the U.S. Army at the School of the Americas. And the plan was that Aristide would never come back, that they'd eventually hold elections, and that FRAP would come into power legitimately, like ARENA has done in El Salvador. You just saw Joe Sacca get elected in El Salvador, and IRI was down there. The International Republican Institute has been a longtime backer of ARENA. But the problem was the Congressional Black Caucus pressured Bill Clinton to reinstall Aristide, and the IRI had to go back to the drawing board. So what the IRI is the International Republican Institute. So what the International Republican Institute did was they wanted access to all the opponents of Aristide, who were totally discredited, and many of them were affiliated with Duvalier, had terrible human rights records. And to get access to them, they hired a guy named Stanley Lucas, who is a smooth-talking Caribbean judo champion and a well-connected socialite, who is the son of a pro-Duvalier Haitian landowning family. And his family is notorious in Haiti because immediately after Duvalier's regime crumbled and the popular democracy movement began, there was a protest for land redistribution on his family's land. His family organized a mob to hack to death 250 peasants. Nevertheless, Stanley Lucas managed to find a job at the International Republican Institute in Washington. And what they did was they dispatched him to organize all the opponents of Aristide. From 1998 to 2002, that meant $2 million to Aristide's opponents for training sessions, communication, teaching them communications and shuttling them to Washington and the Dominican Republic to meet with Republican lawmakers for lobbying sessions. At the same time, Aristide was blocked from going to Washington. George Bush refused to meet with Aristide at the same time. So here's where there's no bipartisanship. There's these characters like, for instance, Prosper Avril, the former Haitian dictator who tortured his opponents, was welcomed with open arms by Republicans. At the same time, they wouldn't negotiate with Aristide. So essentially what you have is a self-fulfilling prophecy. They're imposing sanctions. They're bolstering his opponents. His opponents they boycotted the presidential election of 2000. So you have an intransigent opposition bolstered by the International Republican Institute and trained by a guy who many suspect is a CIA agent, Stanley Lucas. And with these sanctions, Aristide is forced to manage scarcity, which means that he's appearing increasingly corrupt and repressive, and his police force is beleaguered, and he's forced to hire gangs to crack down on the opposition. So
it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. I mean, there's no point in even trying to defend Aristide.
No, there
That's
really
not
isn't.
The issue. The issue is what we seem to have here is an alternative CIA, in effect.
Right,
the IRI,
right.
This is the picture you're painting for me, and I'm just responding to it. It looks as if what's happened is that they've been able to fund the International Republican Institute, put all these zealous hardliners in there, and essentially do regime change
right.
on the cheap without
right.
having to do it through the CIA, and you can see what's happening, how much the CIA is rebelling against the Bush administration,
right.
and the Bush administration in turn is trying to blame the CIA for its blunders in Iraq.
Right. And at the same time, the Bush administration, you know, when the coup happened, the Bush administration only had to approach it as an inevitability, even though there'd been a 10-year destabilization process in the works in the country. And while all this was going on in the open, while all these parties were being organized in the open, while, you know, the leaders were being shuttled to Washington or to the Dominican Republic to meet with congressional Republicans, to meet with Roger Noriega, who's now the Assistant Secretary for the Western Hemisphere. He had a number of meetings with Haitian opposition leaders. There was a group training on the Dominican-Haitian border, and they were preparing for a violent coup. And the International Republican Institute fervently denies that they ever dealt with this group. This group was militarily, this group was led by a guy named Guy Philippe, who's a former Haitian police chief, who's known to have killed people, who staged raids on Haitian police stations from his camp on the border, and who is a reputed drug trafficker. He's also a longtime friend of Stanley Lucas, International Republican Institute's program officer. I interviewed Guy Philippe on his cell phone, and he said, oh yeah, Stanley's a good friend of mine. Everyone knows him. And he told me they'd had meetings. And this is in total contravention to the International Republican Institute's guidelines and the guidelines of its funders. And in fact, the International Republican Institute, you know, without solicitation, issued a press release saying, we have never dealt with Guy Philippe, which is just a lie. A journalist from Le Monde told me that Guy Philippe's political advisor was a frequent guest at International Republican Institute meetings that were convened quite discreetly. So this is how they're operating in Latin America.
So they're active, I believe. IRI was active in Venezuela.
In Venezuela,
weren't they the ones that sort of brokered that coup that took place?
Well, they were working with a number of the groups that participated in the coup, and on the eve of the coup, when it appeared that it was successful, the head of the International Republican Institute at the time, Loren Craner, who is also one of the chiefs of the Republican National Committee, said, this is a victory for democracy. The following day, Chavez came back into power, and Kramer had his head chopped off, so to speak. It was a total embarrassment, and he had to resign. But he kind of showed his true colors. They're still active in Venezuela. They're funding a lot of the groups that are trying to get Chavez out through the recall. And they're active in El Salvador. They're active in before the war in Iraq in trying to get European right wing parties to support the war. They hosted a conference in Prague in 2002 to rally support for the war. All I'm talking about is instances that are of public record. It's hard to really know what they're doing, what their agenda is. They have been known to collaborate with, intelligence services and the CIA on operations, like including an operation in Belarusia to destabilize the government called White Stork. It happened to be a repressive, terrible government, so no one really complained. But is this...
Still is.
Yeah, and it still is. Is this a group that taxpayers should be funding?
Well, that's what it's. That's what I read into what you've uncovered here, Max Blumenthal, is that they've essentially, you know, remember Oliver North during the Iran Contra, he wanted an off-the-shelf operation.
Yeah.
That was a cutout in effect. Let me again remind the audience, I'm speaking with Max Blumenthal, an investigative reporter who writes for Salon.com and The American Prospect, and his piece in Salon.com. It is in the current issue, right?
Yeah, it's on the cover. It's in the current issue. It'll be running till Monday, and okay, you can find it archived there. It's called The Other Regime Change.
But let's talk about the other work you've been doing for The American Prospect on what's happening in terms of the Republicans funding Ralph Nader, both in terms of getting ballot access. It's been clear in Oregon that Republicans have been funding the efforts to get him on the ballot there.
Right.
And in Wisconsin, it's two. He's been challenged a couple of times, and he basically says, well, you know, if rich Republicans want to give me money, you know, I can't refuse them. And he's taking money from a group called Citizens for a Sound Economy that is a national organization led by the former House Majority Leader, Dick Armey. And he's been some of the biggest donors to, probably the biggest donors, in fact, to NADA's campaign have been Charles G. and David H. Koch, K-O-C-H, who have a net worth of about $4 billion apiece. They're on the Forbes list of the 50 richest people in America. And their father, Fred Koch, an oil and gas entrepreneur, was the founding member of the far-right John Birch Society.
Right.
So what's going on here? I mean, how can the Green – I mean, the Green Party didn't
rejected want, him.
They rejected him.
I think they were aware of what was going on.
Right. So what can you figure out that's going on? I mean, you'd think that people who voted for NADA last time who believed that there was no difference between Al Gore and George W. Bush, they may have second thoughts now, but you would think that the fact that the Republicans are funding – efforts to get NADA on the ballots as many states as they can and directly funding him,
yeah,
that would make people think, wouldn't it? I mean...
Yeah, I guess I'm not going to question Ralph Nader's motivation personally, but it should make everyone question what his motivation is for running since he's yet to disavow any of these groups. And in a debate with Howard Dean, he said, hey, Republicans are people too. You know, you forgot to mention that the Oregon Family Council worked the phones for a week to get their people to sign Nader petitions. The Oregon Family Council is the group that is behind the anti-gay marriage ballot amendment in Oregon that will be on the ballot in November. Why won't Nader disavow this group? Now, what I did was I conducted an investigation into how Ralph Nader got on the ballot in Arizona, because I try to follow Arizona politics closely. You know, it's a fascinating state.
But it's a swing state in this.
And it's a swing state in this election. And he really went all out to get on that ballot. And I'm going to try and go through this as quickly as possible, but it's very complicated what he did. To get on a ballot, you have to get a certain amount of signatures. To get signatures, and if you're running a grassroots campaign, you have volunteers go out and do it. And, you know, you would expect Ralph Nader to run a grassroots campaign. Instead, he solicited a Republican petition company that collects petitions for Walmart and Philip Morris and collected, you know, helped get, you know, various Republican candidates on the ballot. They rejected him, but referred him to another petitioner who at the time was in Arizona collecting signatures for Protect Arizona Now, an anti-immigrant initiative, a draconian initiative. And what they did was they paired the Nader ballot, the Nader petition, with the Protect Arizona Now petition. So, you know, if you were coming out of, you know, in a parking lot in Arizona, someone would come up to you with a ballot that says, someone would come up to you with a petition and said, that would say, do you want to sign for Protect Arizona Now and keep these people from taking our jobs? And if you're a right winger, you're going to say, yeah. And then the next petition that you would get would say, would you like to sign a petition to get an independent candidate on the ballot? The petition did not say Ralph Nader's name at the top. So as it happened, 65% of the petitions that were signed for Ralph Nader to get him on the ballot in Arizona came from Republicans who were probably anti-immigrant Republicans. Another reason that he got on the ballot in Arizona is that the former head of the Christian Coalition in the state had secretly funded petitioners to collect signatures for Ralph Nader.
Did he get on the ballot? I thought he's accused the Democrats of using dirty tricks to get him off.
He wound up getting 21,000 signatures. To get on the Arizona ballot, you need 14,000 signatures. He got 21,000. The reason he was knocked off the ballot was not for any of the reasons I've stated. He got knocked off because the majority of the people who signed for him were not registered voters or were convicted felons. So basically, and there was some criminal activity involved, including petitioners lying about their home addresses because they weren't even from Arizona. And, you know, according to Arizona law, you have to be from Arizona. But he was covertly funded by Nathan Sproul, who's the former head of the Christian Coalition there, who's famous for this kind of activity. And he's doing it in states across the country. If you look at any of his ballot bids, any of his bids to get on the ballot for November, he's relying almost exclusively on Republican money. He's paying petitioners. It's not a grassroots campaign by any means. And
when you say the Nathan Sproul, he's working with him. What give me a sense
well,
of
what Nathan's
collusion there.
What Nathan Sproul did was he would pay bonuses to petitioners who were collecting signatures for Protect Arizona Now, and they would come back to give him the signatures, and he would pay them the money. And to cover his tracks, what he did was he had his secretary drive the petitions over to a motel where the woman hired by the Nader campaign to collect signatures was staying, and she'd mix the petitions in with hers, so he completely covered his tracks. But this is outside money outside of the Nader campaign, paying for their signatures. And they told me that, you know, Nader's spokesman said, we only heard of Nathan Sproul, you know, a week ago, and, you know, I'd be surprised if any of this is true. But the reason that they're getting on ballots is because the Republicans want them to get on ballots. It's in the Florida Republican Party. I don't know if it's still on their website, but a few weeks ago, their website, you know, you go right to the website, it says Run Ralph Run, and it's attacking the Democrats for trying to knock Ralph Nader off the ballot. So what, you know, this.
But there's a difference between them encouraging it verbally and actively, funding
right.
efforts.
Right. And, you know, there's verbal encouragement. Many of Ralph Nader's donors, especially his biggest donors, have also donated to George Bush and have a long history of donating to the Republican Party. I think it just calls into question, Ralph Nader's beliefs if he's not going to disavow piggybacking on a petition for an anti-immigrant initiative. I mean, Ralph Nader sat down with Pat Buchanan for American Conservative magazine for an interview because he's actively trying to solicit right-wing voters. And he said, we have to control our immigration. We have to limit the number of people who come to this country illegally. I don't like the idea of legalization because then the question is, how do you prevent the next wave and the next? That sounds like something Pat Buchanan would say, but Ralph Nader said it. How principled is he? I'm not going to make a statement on it, but it does call into question his beliefs. And I asked his campaign headquarters for his position on immigration. And what I got was so convoluted, I couldn't even tell what he believed. One thing I know for a fact is that he opposes amnesty for undocumented workers. But just in
closing, we've got 1 minute left here. What's when you've got people like Dick Armey and Boyden Gray, the former counsel to George W. Herbert Walker Bush, 41, working to get Nader on the ballots in these swing states like Wisconsin, Florida, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and he tried to get on in Arizona and didn't. Where does it stand? Is he going to get on in Wisconsin, Florida, Michigan, and Pennsylvania?
You know, I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. I assume that if he stays in the campaign, you can only assume that he's going to make some kind of impact. And
well, he's gotten the Reform Party to let him piggyback on their ballot.
Right.
Access.
Well, he's endorsed by the Reform Party and he's accepted it. And the Reform Party believes in putting troops on the border to stop immigrants from coming in.
Right.
The Reform Party is one of the most extreme right-wing parties in the country. So it just calls into question why he's running. And you can only hope that if he runs, that he doesn't try and deny that he didn't turn the election to George W. Bush if George W. Bush wins by a few hundred votes.
I thank you for joining us, Max Blumenthal, and for both of your articles on the IRI, the International Republic Institute, which people should be looking at as a kind of alternative Republican-controlled off-the-shelf CIA, and also for reporting on Republicans for Nader. I thank the engineer, Max Maxwell. I thank my producer, Lewis Vandenberg, and production help from Grant Gruber and Carol Coote.